This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Robert St. George and I'm delighted to be joined today by Sonia Loud, our CIO, Ed Wicks, our head of trading, and Howie Lee, head of ETFs here at LGIM. Hello everyone and thank you for joining us on this podcast. Sonia, if I may start with you. After some turmoil in China's property market at the start of last week, markets seemed to regain their poise very quickly, even as the Federal Reserve moved closer to tapering its asset purchases. What do you think investors need to know about all these recent developments and the month ahead?
Yes, thank you. And good morning, everyone. A lot going on clearly in China, and it's not just Evergrande, but clearly a lot of focus on the regulatory clampdown by the Chinese government. But you can see from the market reaction that clearly that there is an expectation that the government will step in and make sure that this is an orderly wind down, an orderly, you know, default, if any. And so we are still waiting for more detail, but clearly this is what the market is telling us. Now, I think taking a step back from the immediate turmoil that created, we still need to put this in context of, one, the economic developments globally, two, vaccinations versus virus, Delta in particular, and three, obviously, you know, the policy response. You've mentioned tapering already. It's, of course, all eyes on inflationary pressures emerging versus the communication we get from global central banks. And I think investors really should look at these separately in order to get a better understanding of where we are in the global cycle and what we should think about the opportunity set in global markets. Now, starting as always with the virus and the vaccination situation, I think nothing new really, other than that, yes, we are seeing the Delta variant popping up around the world. We see regional lockdowns. But if anything, market participants look at this and say, okay, maybe this has a timing impact, but it will not derail the normalization and hence the economic strength that we have been seeing. So I think from that angle, we are still using the assumption that vaccinations will remain effective. And we have seen a particularly positive impact on hospitalization. So despite the fact that we have seen an increase in infection rates, hospitalization really remain very low. With that in mind, global economic developments have been very strong. We have seen the US first, now Europe had a very strong summer, and now market participants start thinking about what's next in the economic cycle. We have talked about the fact that the speed with which the cycle unfolds is faster than normal, and hence quite normally we see the Fed now talking about tapering because we're obviously closing output gaps, we're seeing unemployment fall, and this is clearly the story for 2022. Now, inflation has probably been the headline grabber number one over the most recent period. And this is clearly because it is the key ingredient in order to judge what central banks are doing next. Now, tapering has now so well flagged that markets, again, take it into their stride, make a tick in the box. And as long as the economic outlook remains as strong as it is, it's very clear that the market is well prepared for a reduction in the monthly buying program by global central banks. But what we should not forget, inflation clearly holds the key in understanding what the interest rate cycle is going to look like. And that to us, obviously, as a big bond investor, is a very, very important part of looking forward. Now, we have talked about in previous podcasts this idea temporary versus sustained. We have talked at length about used car prices, you know, airfares, hotel room prices, and those all fall into the category of temporary rather than sustained. And we are already seeing some of these normalizing. What we are watching more carefully is labor market dynamics. And obviously the headline just over the weekend here in the UK is looking at labor market shortages, i.e. skill shortages in lorry drivers. We are looking at some, you know, empty supermarket shelves. We are hearing from industries around the world that there's issues with regards to skill sets being available. And this is what we're watching carefully because that might be more sustained inflationary pressures because, you know, simply put, you know, companies will have to pay up to get the right skill set through the door. And if this were not to normalize post furlough schemes rolling off, post the payment protection scheme rolling off, then clearly this is something we need to watch very carefully. Our base case still is for a more normalized inflationary backdrop by the end of next year. And then obviously with all eyes on how the labor market might work a turnout in 2023, because it's really when the economy is overheating, we will see more pressures emerging. And if it's when the interest rate cycle starts, obviously investors will take note. Although it's arguably, you know, looking at valuations right now, we might see more volatility going forward. Now, just to very briefly finish off, if we do look at current valuation levels, and this is what a lot of investors are approaching us about, is what do I do? We have obviously very, very tight spreads across the whole credit spectrum. We have very low bond yields around the world, and we have equity valuation levels that clearly can be called elevated and in some areas probably extended. So where do you find the opportunities? And that clearly is, given the economic backdrop I've just outlined, is not an easy task. And so we have talked about structural themes for quite some time, and we continue to think that, point one, equities are the preferred asset class because it's still a positive economic backdrop and so favors risk assets. But we are really looking to find structural themes and investment opportunities for us to find those areas that will continue to outgrow the global economy even beyond 2022-23.
Wonderful. Thank you for that excellent overview of markets and conditions today. If I can just link together two of the points you made. First, on the market not seeming to price in any kind of crisis in China, and second, on valuations remaining elevated. Can you see any kind of complacency creeping into markets about the potential for a systemic risk emanating from China's property sector in particular?
Yeah, no, this is a very fair point. And as I tried to say right at the beginning, the market assumes that the government will step in. The property sector in China is 25% of GDP. So investors should take note, because if we're not talking about an orderly but a disorderly default or unwind of the Evergrande debt, then clearly this would have implications for global markets. And you see that the calmness tells you that there's an expectation that the Chinese government is fully aware not only of the size of the property sector, but two, that Evergrande is the most indebted property company globally. And as such, there's an obligation to make sure that this is not having broader implications. But I have highlighted as well the, you know, regulatory crackdown. And so obviously investors do look at China, and there is an understanding that this is done with a strategic vision of rebalancing the Chinese economy. But I think what investors will do is, what kind of equity risk premium is the right one in the context of, you know, a more severe, you know, intervention by the government. And obviously we still obviously the aftermath of the Evergrande situation and how the government can actually manage all of this in one go. So, you know, it is clearly something to look out for, but for the time being, our expectation alongside the market is that we will hear the government step in, but making sure that this is done in a context that can prevent global implications or a global spillover.
Wonderful, thank you. Now, I'm so glad that, Ed, you could join us here, because you have a frontline view of what investors are actually doing in their trading. So on that first point about expectations, what kind of activity are you seeing from your team around China and associated markets?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting to hear what Sonia says there. And broadly speaking, from a trading perspective, I would absolutely agree. You know, high level trading conditions in China currently would indicate to us that certainly this crisis can be contained to some extent. Now, of course, on the flip side to that, it's a very fast changing situation. So we wouldn't want to get complacent with that view, and it's something we would keep continually under watch. However, from our perspective, trading in those local markets, it does seem to be relatively well contained at present. I think there is a good degree of separation from whether you're an international investor or a more local investor. And I think the sentiment will be different depending on that to some extent. But again, there are certain aspects that have occurred in the market in the last, you know, several weeks that give a lot of confidence. A good example of that would be the sort of scale and speed of the PBOC intervention in terms of liquidity injections. I think that's helped calm quite a few nerves. And then if you look more broadly across sort of Chinese equity markets, currency markets, they certainly seem a lot more orderly, and we're seeing a lot more sort of resilience in terms of liquidity. So on the whole, yeah, it's not too bad at present.
Wonderful. That's great news. Thank you, Ed. And if I can stay with you on the second key topic that Sonia mentioned, inflation, what kind of trading activity are you seeing around inflation-linked assets right now? From tips to say infrastructure equity or commodities, what kind of activity are you seeing there?
Yeah, similar again to Sonia's comments, inflation is incredibly important in the market right now. It's a data point that almost everyone is analysing every day. For us at Elgin, in inflation-linked products, they're extremely important component of our business. From a trading perspective, they form an important asset class for us. We are very active across both cash and derivative markets within inflation globally. What I would say is that the actual proportion of index-linked trading activity we've seen year to date, if I compare that to the same period in 2020, we've definitely seen an increase in the region of sort of 8 to 10%. So relatively meaningful there, actually. And the other observation, if I look at our business, is the proportion of index-linked products that make up our entire government bond activity has also shifted considerably. So inflation is definitely getting more important for us. What I would say about UK markets in particular is a couple of things. First is, if you're looking across the front end, for example, the price action is incredibly strong, as everyone's seen. We've seen both 5-year and 10-year break-evens in September reach all-time highs, which is a really great indication of the strength of the market. The other thing that we're seeing, obviously, in the front end is this volatility piece. And we touched on a few of these reasons earlier. Perhaps one of the most obvious ones is this recent, very well documented spike in energy prices. And that feeds through into the market, which of course delivers a challenging liquidity picture for us to cope with. Away from the front end, if we look sort of more at the long end in the UK, what we're seeing there in the market as a whole is a very robust demand coming into the end of the year. So I think, a lot of market participants are going to be looking very carefully at the supply calendar for the rest of 2021.
I see. Thank you. Now, Sonia, if I may come back to you, to link together two of these points about high inflation and possible risks from China, those two concerns may explain some of the echoing of the word stagflation around markets right now. I think you explained why it's not something we are massively concerned about, but do you think that kind of fear could escalate in the months ahead?
No, it clearly got a lot of support recently because, as Ed highlighted, we're facing a number of bottlenecks around markets, and that clearly is creating uncertainty. It creates price pressures and price spikes in certain parts of the market. And as such, if you look forward and you think about the potential impact of either the Delta variant, regional lockdown, so that growth is already past its peak, then obviously you have this uncomfortable combination of rising prices with slowing growth, and hence the idea of stagflation. Now, we would argue that for it to be signified as a time period of stagflation, it should be longer and clearly not based on such well-documented bottlenecks in the market that are creating the distortion in prices. And as such, we are still relatively comfortable that we're not entering a renewed period of stagflation. Interestingly, when we started debating this, I think we came to realize that none of our investment teams really ever had to deal with inflation during our time in markets, right? I mean, the only period where stagflation, or the inflation, was a real problem was the 70s. And I can admit that this is the time period when I was born. So clearly not something that I had to deal with in my professional life. And that's the fascinating bit, because it is creating a lot of uncertainty because it never really has been an issue. We have been obviously confronted with a very benign global backdrop, inflationary backdrop, for roughly 40 years, and hence bond markets have been so well supported for that period of time. Inflation in and of itself is not bad, and you know, we've been very worried about deflation for a very long period of time. So I think the worry only emerges because there's this fear that it would be uncontrollable inflation. And obviously bottlenecks and disruption creates price jumps that feel uncontrollable. But we would argue that, you know, we should try and look beyond the level of normalization and only then really try and form a picture on what are structural price pressures that are here to stay versus disruptive, you know, price jumps that are linked to either the lack of skill sets or the lack of commodities, the lack of components that create obviously disruption around the world. We should not underestimate that this is probably here to stay for a bit longer. And as I said, the headlines over the weekend here in the UK do not make for very pretty reading. We are running out of petrol. We are looking at empty supermarket shelves. And so of course it creates fear, and we need to prepare for that. But if we look at the longer term economic cycles, then clearly we still believe that we are looking for normalization towards the end of next year.
Wonderful, thank you. Now, Howie, if I may turn to you here, part of your role is to invest in high growth themes. So if stagflation isn't our base case, but we are preparing for slowing economic growth and higher inflation for a while at least, what could that do to these kind of high growth themes that you work to identify?
Yeah, thanks, Robin. That's a great question. And just following on from what Sonia was saying earlier, clearly, you know, we do still need to focus on those two elements, you know, what's happening with the economic growth, what's happening with inflation. You know, at the beginning of the year, we saw people getting more and more interested in areas such as commodities. But we also know that commodities are made up of not just energy, but also of resources and the like. And so I think, first of all, when looking at inflation, there are certainly some investors who have positioning themselves, utilizing a broad set of commodity solutions, of which we've been helping them through. But looking more around economic growth, whilst the overall economic growth rate might look like it might be slowing, that doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't sectors or new industries that aren't busy or booming. And so what we would say certainly is, in the near to medium term, if stagflation is really a concern, then there's lots of discussions to be had around investing in materials. But I think more longer term, it's about investing in the future. What we do here is identify long-term themes where the growth drivers are less affected by the economic cycle. So we're looking at things like digitalization that's making the world much more efficient, looking at how we consume our resources. But we shouldn't also forget that demographics will continue to play a big picture in terms of identifying new areas of the demand. You know, for us, identifying companies leading the way with innovations and essentially building a new economy or ecosystem is really how we play the long-term growth theme rather than just the short-term side of things. And we would always do that by essentially focusing on very specific companies so that we can essentially highlight unique opportunities for investors to sit alongside traditional building blocks. And these unique opportunities are essentially only capable of being identified through active research. But of course, we want to invest in a way where we're providing investors with growth via diversification, rather than growth via concentration risk. So, you know, this is very much about working with our experts to invest in companies which are investing their capital, positioning their strategy for these long-term themes, such as clean energy, and really be able to highlight those unique opportunities, which are destined to grow some more into 10, 15 years plus.
Great. Wonderful, optimistic note there. Thank you. One of the source of positivity in markets right now, I suppose, is the general lack of volatility we've seen for a good few months now. Ed, again, you are on the front line of global trading. What kind of summer have you had with a fairly muted volatility backdrop? And are you seeing anything that might change that in the weeks or months ahead?
Yeah, so in terms of volatility, look, I mean, it's definitely true to say that we remain at the lower levels, and we have been there for some time. I mean, if you look at equities, you know, they're incredibly resilient. You look at where the S&P is now, and okay, maybe it's paused its relentless grind higher, but earlier on in September, it reached all-time highs. If you look across investment-grade credit markets, you can see that the bid-offer spreads that we're experiencing in those markets are incredibly tight, tighter than pre-pandemic. So the conditions are really interesting at the moment for us from a trading perspective, because what this lack of volatility does, it really allows us to take advantage and continue reducing our trading costs for the benefit of our clients. So that's an important point to make. In terms of looking ahead, now, it's always incredibly difficult to predict, of course, but if you take a step back and look at the broader market globally, you can see some of the things that we've mentioned on this call. You've got loads of headwinds coming up. You've got debt ceiling in the US, tapering we've discussed already, China, global elections is another big one, inflation, Delta variants, of course, which ironically are coming last on that list, but nonetheless are still in existence. So, you know, if I look at all of those and then factor in where we are in terms of the year coming into Q4 and year end, there's always a risk coming into year end that we see difficult funding conditions. So if you sort of put all those headwinds together and you add in where we are in the year coming into year end, I would say on balance, there's probably a good chance that we see a bit more volatility in the coming months.
Yeah, I see. Thank you. You mentioned funding conditions there. And we heard last week from the Fed some more clarity on the likely timing of their tapering. You've invested and traded through plenty of periods of tightening liquidity in the past. What are you expecting this time around?
I suppose what I'm expecting, and we've seen some of this to be fair already, is a really high degree of communication from the policymakers, from the Fed. I think if we get that continued high level of communication and the Fed remains flexible and looks at the prevailing market conditions rather than dogmatically sticking to a timetable, we should be in a reasonable place. I think market participants, traders, etc., wouldn't expect too dramatic a reaction to a considered tapering from here. It's been very well documented. A lot of it must be priced in by now. People are expecting it. However, on the flip side of that, the concern is going to be how quickly they move with that tapering. And if it does occur too fast, what that means for the broader market and how far forward that brings prospective rate rises. So I think it's the speed that we've got to be really careful and look at. And I said it before, but you know, it is really important point, and it is that proximity to year end. Every year there are difficulties for various structural reasons at year end, particularly in short-term funding markets. And what I would not like to see is that year end is exacerbated by a sort of a tapering ambition that might be too fast.
I see. Thank you. And Sonia, if I could pose the same kind of question to you. You've invested through previous episodes of tapering and lower liquidity conditions. What do you think we should expect and prepare for this time around?
It's very clear that the central banks are learning from the episodes of the past and have in doubt over-communicated than too little. And to me, the importance is the potential unknowns that we currently haven't really factored in, because the tapering path is based on very distinct assumptions around the economic developments and the inflationary backdrop that would allow the Fed to start the tapering process. So anything that would derail those assumptions clearly would then have the opportunity to derail markets. And as Ed said, you know, the assumption that the Delta variant is not, you know, spreading further. The assumption that we will not see another variant that potentially is resistant to existing vaccines, that's all base assumptions that have to go into the market narrative that tapering can start at year end. And so we have to be prepared that, of course, there can be events happening that would derail that path and then clearly would have the opportunity to create a lot more volatility. This is why I have mentioned valuation levels already. There is not a big margin of safety in any of these valuation levels. Spread are at historic lows. Government bond yields are at historic lows. And equity market valuations are very reflective of the positive economic backdrop. So you have to be prepared, and you should always assess the risk you're taking in your current asset allocation against the potential that something is not going to plan as it has been outlined by the current narrative. And I think that clearly then would create potential bottlenecks, that would create more dislocation and volatility, and understanding where the biggest risk is sitting within a asset allocation context, I think is what we would always suggest is right now to do.
I see, thank you very much. And Howie, while we have you, I wanted to ask you about the Fed's purchases of bond ETFs. It's been quite an exciting experiment for those investing in the ETF market. What do you think of the Fed beginning to sell those? Does that have any wider implications, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, clearly the Fed selling off its bond ETF holdings is just an expression of their economic policy. So connected to what Sonia was just saying there earlier, look, central banks are making that statement, and they are actually just taking some action in essentially selling off the bonds. The fact that they decided to go down the ETF route rather than the bond route obviously doesn't have any effect to the underlying market. They're still accessing those bonds. And in this case, they're selling the bonds. And what, you know, bearing in mind, they actually own a very small proportion of the total kind of bonds that are out there based on what they're investing in. So really what they're experiencing coming out will be their same experience coming in, which is it's an easy to use vehicle for a single trade diversification, rather than having to buy the individual bonds and look at the liquidity and focus on the risks of doing that. They're doing it through essentially a package, a single trade, and they get exposure to bond. A single trade out means that they're actually able to sell off the bonds. You're actually allowing the market to find efficiencies on where those bonds go. Now, it might be the individual bonds may go into other investors interested in that ETF, or actually it might hit some of the market makers and find its way to other parts of the portfolio. But what that's obviously doing is adding some stock back in relation to those bonds. But, you know, at the end of the day, the journey for the Fed has been a single vehicle where they're able to invest and come out. And they have been able to benefit from the access and the management of that liquidity via the ETF providers. But also, more importantly, as we had learned last year back in April, they're able to see the transparency of the pricing of the underlying bonds. That's what the ETF vehicle has been proven to be able to do, which is to be able to give a real-time price indicator of the cost of buying those bonds or the cost of selling those bonds on exchange every single day. But we should remember that not all bonds are the same. And so when we're talking about ETFs, not all ETFs are the same either. We would certainly suggest investors to look at ways to avoid the crowds, manage the liquidity, and there's definitely value to be extracted through understanding essentially maturity and downgrades in any given bond portfolio.
Great, thank you very much. One final word on the Fed, if we may. The Fed and the dollar are obviously very closely linked. We posted a blog on the Elgin blog last week about trading conditions in currencies and how volatility there has been declining quite markedly over the past few months. Ed, if I can ask you, what's been happening in currencies and can you see anything changing there?
Yeah, so the blog you referenced from our asset allocation team was spot on. Volatility and broader market conditions across currency markets are incredibly benign right now. We don't see any great catalyst that moves that in the very short term. Moreover, what we've been focusing on the trading side is using those market conditions to our benefit. The way we've really gone about that is to start to increase the amount of algorithmic trading that we're doing in currency markets. It's obviously a very good time given the benign conditions. So we've moved now for our sort of outright FX business to doing about probably in excess of 50% algorithmically. And that brings a lot of benefits that we can obviously pass on to our clients. The first most obvious benefit is the reduction in transaction costs that we've been able to experience by using that execution channel, which is really important. Obviously, executing in this way, it gives us a much higher degree of anonymity and control as well, which is also a benefit. And then I think finally, which is sometimes overlooked, the third benefit of trading in this way is that we're able to collect far more granular data from our executing activities. And what that does is that it enables us to calibrate and recalibrate what we're doing and ultimately learn from our trading and improve it over time. So it's a really important aspect. And all of these things are obviously benefits that we're able to pass on in terms of superior trading performance to clients.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you. And now, Ed, if I could just stick with you for a second longer. We haven't spoken to you since the meme stock frenzy began earlier this year. As a trader and the manager of a trading team, have you ever seen anything like this meme stock frenzy we've seen in 2021?
Yeah, the meme frenzy was really interesting to watch, I have to say. I mean, largely a US phenomenon, obviously. But I think it was followed by a lot of people. And I think one of the reasons for that is, you know, in a lot of the press, it was almost being documented and as Main Street versus Wall Street and, you know, David taking on Goliath and all these types of descriptions. But taking a step back and how we arrived at where we got to with this meme frenzy, I think there are two things that we could point to. You know, the incredibly accommodative conditions in US economic policy currently is one reason that some people point to. But there's another reason as well, and one that I'll go into in a bit more detail, and that is the actual structure of US equity markets. If you look at US equity markets, they do have a very high retail component to them, somewhere in the region of 20 to 25%, something like that. Now, when an individual in the US wants to purchase or sell an equity, they'll go to their retail broker typically. That retail broker will then route their order to a market maker. The market maker won't charge the retail broker for that service. Moreover, what they will do is compensate the retail broker for sending them that order. And therefore, what happens is the retail broker is able to offer their services to individuals on a zero commission basis. So optically, to the individual, they might think that they're trading for free. Now, this arrangement is pretty well documented and it's known as payment for order flow. It's incredibly topical in the US at the moment, but why people are talking about it in the context of memes is that they're saying, well, look, if people are able to trade in this environment and they look at it at zero commissions and they feel like they're trading for free, did that structural element of US equity markets exacerbate the situation that we saw and contribute to that meme frenzy? So that's why it's getting a lot of airtime. And actually, I believe the SEC is due to complete its long-awaited report into the meme frenzy in the coming weeks. And I would expect there to be at least some mention of payment for order flow and how it views that going forwards.
Yeah, really interesting to keep watching that, Ed. Thank you. Sonia, if I can just come to you on the same topic. What do you make of all this? Do you think that this broader participation in financial markets is positive, or could it perhaps undermine the work of responsible investors trying to act as stewards?
I think in general, broader participation is positive. And I think the US, as Ed has just said, clearly has a much higher participation rate than other countries. And I know that looking back at my native Germany, we would like to see higher participation rates and equity ownership, because clearly, you know, if you think about the idea of long-term wealth creation and savings, then equities have to play an important role, and hence creating that level of interest and that level of participation has to be a good thing. Now, whether you want to replicate what Ed has just highlighted in terms of that perceived, you know, I can trade for free, probably creates unintended consequences that have implications on trading levels and then on individual names that waiting for the SEC outcome. I'm pretty sure the regulator would like to make sure that in future can be avoided so that there's no kind of disruption to orderly market functioning. But in general, I think we have to differentiate between the mechanics that have led to it versus participation, which I believe in general is always a positive because it is linked to long-term wealth creation and savings.
Great, thank you very much. And similarly on meme stocks, Howie, I know you look for sustainable growth in your themes rather than memes. But given that you look for such high growth names, and also in the kind of smaller cap element of the market, often tech disruptors, there must occasionally be some overlap. So how do you go about kind of thinking about when these meme stocks occur in your portfolios? How do you approach this part of the market?
Yeah, sure. It's definitely worth highlighting that we obviously don't build our investment strategies around these memes. And our approach has been established for well over 7 or 8 years now. And what we really want to be doing is identifying unique stocks together with our dedicated experts from the bottom up, really understand what they do, what the strategy of their business is, in how they're investing their capital in essentially focusing on that theme in particular, and then also following their journey as to, well, what are the fundamentals looking like? What's the sales growth? And that's why we very regularly put spotlight on individual companies on our quarterly thematic reports. And we also like to talk about the tailwinds and headwinds on a quarterly basis as well for each theme. But if you look at our investment approach, yes, we're identifying companies, and you might find, and it's been very rare, there might be one stock or two that gets picked out perhaps in the future by these meme stocks. However, our approach is not to try to provide growth through the fortunes or misfortunes of any single one company. Again, I mentioned earlier, it's about growth by diversification. So, you know, if you take an equally weighted approach as a broad foundation as a starting place, we obviously make adjustments based on certain data that we have, but also especially to cap any position holding that we have to ensure that we have and are able to maintain liquidity in the portfolios. You know, at any given point, there might just be a percentage or a half, or maybe up to 3.5% in any portfolio rebalance where we might own one single stock. And so really when that happens is, even if there was an overlap and a stock that we hold ended up becoming a meme stock, any kind of volatility driven by the retail behavior is going to have little effect on our portfolios. Bearing in mind, again, we are targeting the growth of the theme itself, and therefore we're trying to identify all companies which are contributing to the growth of that new industry or ecosystem. And so very kind of low correlation or link to this meme stock phenomenon that we've seen in 2021.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And while we're with you, Howie, can I also discuss cybersecurity with you? That's sure. one of the themes that you have identified. And we've seen some very high profile hacks and attacks so far this year. So from your perspective, is the cybersecurity industry rising to meet this growing threat?
Do you know what the crazy thing is, Rob? You know, these high-profile attacks haven't stopped. They were there 6 years ago when we started the portfolio. They were there 5 years ago, and every single year, and if not, it's actually growing. Bearing in mind, we're hearing about the reported attacks, not the attacks which are not reported, of which obviously there will be many because it can be quite sensitive information for anyone's business strategy. So we have to take the base case that cybersecurity is here to stay. The threats will continue to come. New threats come to the fore all the time. And unfortunately, we are still at the point where the solutions are still trying to catch up to the new threats that come in. Now, cybersecurity has advanced quite a bit over the last 6 or 7 years, but you know, by no means is there going to be a complete solution that's is going to remain static. This has to be an evolution. There will continue to be new threats and therefore new solutions. And I suppose that's why we want to highlight to investors again, you know, of the 57 companies that we invest in, no one single cybersecurity can take care of everything and address every single threat. This is about a economy or an ecosystem working together to solve the issues. And that's really how we see the cybersecurity opportunity. And as it moves from just putting out solutions out there towards prevention, I think that's when you'll see the industry get ahead of essentially the cyber attackers. But I think one kind of last thing to note on cybersecurity companies, I think what's really interesting about them is they've become very scalable businesses, often cloud-based. Obviously, these different programs working together and often on subscription models. So very interesting from a business model perspective. And of course, when it comes to sales growth, they continue to be attractive. they have been, you know, investors that have been in this for the last 7 years have had a positive experience, you know, with this fund because of the fact that this industry continues to grow every single year to essentially address the issue of cyber attacks.
I see. Thank you very much. Now, one final topic I wanted to cover is COP26. We all know it's now just a few weeks away, and rightfully, lots of the debate around it has centered on what governments and what companies can do to minimize their own carbon profiles. But Howie, I know you have looked quite a lot from a different perspective, the perspective of how different technologies can help us decarbonize the world. So if you wouldn't mind just sharing some of your thoughts on the possibilities there, please.
Yeah, sure. I mean, as it relates to COP26, it's going to be a hugely interesting discussion in a couple of weeks' time. You know, we've already started as a firm working with various investors on positioning their current portfolios. You know, we have discussions with clients on the broader index side and also across the entire investments floor around temperature alignment, you know, how to ensure you have a lower carbon footprint out of your portfolio. But actually, we always want to emphasize to investors not to forget about investing in the companies that will actually get us there. So what do we mean by that? Well, sometimes there are opportunities that are commonly not found in traditional building block portfolios. So if the journey here is about green energy, then, you know, we've been spending actually a lot of time recently speaking to investors and highlighting the opportunities which are available around clean energy generation, clean energy storage, and also hydrogen has been very well covered, certainly in the media and lots of questions from investors on that. But what we'd highlight, and I specifically broken down those three groups, is that, you know, the fundamentals and the drivers of demand are actually quite different when it comes to energy generation as well as energy storage. That's why we treat those two portfolios and those two themes separately. We see in the market quite often they're both together, but then that means that we're actually not able to provide flexibility to work with investors portfolio you know, wants to be positioned towards. And then hydrogen is the question that you know, is in every single conversation relates to energy. We want to highlight that, you know, that certainly is not the be all end all. It has to work in conjunction with other sources of energy like solar, like wind. And hydrogen is at an earlier stage of the theme. And this is early stage because, you know, the goal here is to go towards green hydrogen and blue hydrogen. And that's it's got a much more meaningful and cleaner impact over the next 20 or so years. And that's really where the growth is from. But we have to highlight to investors, and we're very happy to work with them to highlight and go through how hydrogen can be included in the portfolio, but as a component within clean energy generation and storage, you can manage that volatility and still benefit from positioning your portfolio towards the growth in green energy.
Thank you very much. Some really exciting innovations occurring there. So thank you for sharing them with us. Now, Sonia, if we may conclude with you, we published your latest CIO update earlier this month, which was devoted to COP26 and climate change. We will continue to to talk about all those issues in much greater detail across a variety of media in the coming weeks. But for now, what do you think investors need to know about COP26 and investors' role in climate issues?
Yes, COP26 is clearly a very, very big event. And there's a lot of expectation that the discussions that will happen in Glasgow in November will lead to further announcements. I think it's fair to say it will be all eyes on the US, because so far that they have been the laggard in announcing, you know, profound changes to the way they address the path to net zero. Although obviously the Biden administration has made initial steps to align the US back to the Paris Accord. But I think it's fair to say that for us as a global investor, that is the piece of the jigsaw that is missing. We do think that financial markets have an important role to play in addressing climate change. And that means asset owners and asset managers working together in not only understanding the problem statement, but then obviously understanding the journey and the transition that needs to happen. We know that this is not a journey that is the same everywhere. There will be regional differences, that there will be sector differences. And this is why understanding the problem and the transition is so important in order to be there as a responsible partner to the companies we invest in, but to be a partner to our clients as well, to help them in establishing their path to net zero. We've talked a lot about themes today, and clearly climate change is another one where we feel this is a structural driver. It's a structural theme that, yes, obviously there's a big focus on the risk mitigation path, but as Howie just said, that there's an opportunity set aligned to it that we believe investors should be aware of. And at Elgin, we are integrating our knowledge and the transition path into the decision-making process, because we believe that this is one way of making sure that we are delivering relevant investment solutions for our clients and can, you know, spot opportunities that hopefully will allow us to mitigate some of the mediocre return expectations that we are seeing elsewhere.
Wonderful. Thank you. That was a really great point on which to conclude this month's call. So thank you, Sonia. Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Howie, for your time today. And thank you to you, our clients and our listeners, for joining us today. The next edition of the CIO call will be in October. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via our social media channels, on the Elgin blog, and here on Elgin Talks. Thank you again, everyone, for listening.
Enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, elgin.com.